self-sufficiency and spread human dignity throughout the world. AJWS.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In January 2001, on a cool winter day in Washington, Madeleine Albright sat at her desk in the State Department and wrote a letter. It was her last official duty as Secretary of State. "Dear Colin," the letter began, "I turn over to you the best job in the world. Good luck and best wishes, Madeleine." Madeleine Corbell Albright served as American Secretary of State under Bill Clinton from 1997 to 2001. She is the only woman ever to have held the job and the highest-ranking woman in the history of the United States government. Her tenure as State Department chief took her and America through war in Bosnia, Al-Qaeda terrorist bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and the first days of hope for the fragile Mideast peace born in Oslo. Now, nearly 3 years after she wrote her letter to her successor, Colin Powell, Madeleine Albright remains an influential figure on the world stage. September 11th showed that Americans need the active help and cooperation of other countries, Albright writes in the October issue of Foreign Affairs. The United States' cause would therefore be heard more clearly if the administration substituted bridges for bluster and spoke more often of choices relevant to the day-to-day lives of more of the world's people, unquote. Madeleine Albright's intimate new memoir is entitled Madam Secretary. She joins us now from Washington. Welcome, and thanks for being with us, Madeleine Albright.
Great to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you. Lots facing the Bush administration as we talk today. We want to hear a lot about your personal history, but just take us in first as a former Secretary of State. Here we are, 2003, headline in the New York Times this morning, "Rocky Path for Bush, Effort to Remake Iraq Hits Roadblocks." And it's all about President Bush finding major obstacles to his effort to secure and rebuild Iraq. You can well imagine what it must feel like to read those headlines from the inside of an administration. Why do you think, Madeleine Albright, President Bush is hitting roadblocks in his efforts around Iraq?
Well, first of all, let me say that all these things turn out to be much harder than originally planned. I think that we all know that, and those of us that have had jobs on the inside know how difficult they are. I do think, however, the level of difficulty has been increased because as far as I know, the administration had a different plan or thought that life was going to be easier once we liberated Iraq and were greeted as liberators, and that the society there would be so happy to see us that many of the problems that they foresaw that have now come up would not have been there. And I think that one of the main problems here is that there was a overestimation of the support and an underestimation of all the difficulties. We've heard Secretary Rumsfeld say they planned for a lot of things that didn't happen, for which I applaud them. But when you're a policymaker, you also have to have contingency plans for everything.
And things have not all gone perfectly. Madeleine Albright, we're going to come back and get more of your views on what's going on right now in Iraq and around the world. But we want to dive in to this memoir. I have to say, I enjoyed it enormously. It's more intimate and more candid than we often expect, even in a season of memoirs. You've put a lot out on the table here and been extremely forthcoming. And I hope you'll share some of that with us today. I thought I'd just ask you to begin with. You've written in the memoir that in order to know Madeleine Albright, you have to understand your father. Why? How and why did he influence you in such a deep way?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for saying what you did, because my plan was to write a very candid memoir. I think there are lots of secretaries of state who write and other people who write their memoirs, but I felt that there was no value to my just writing down the events that I was involved in if I didn't explain myself properly and let it be clear kind of what I brought to the job and what my baggage is or lack of it. Mm-hmm. And so I have succeeded if you have said that, in fact, it's candid. On the question that you asked me, my father was a huge influence on me, mainly because he was a diplomat and then a professor, and I was ever the dutiful daughter. He was a person who participated fully in the life of Czechoslovakia in the interwar period, a time of growth of democracy and hope, and his life was derailed when the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia in March 1939, and yet again another time when the communists took over in 1948, and when he brought us to the United States. And he was one of these people who drew lessons out of everything and was a born teacher, and I was his best student.
You're famously an immigrant who rose to become Secretary of State, but I'm sure not everyone really understands that story. You were born in Prague, 1937. Give us a sense of your early life and your father's career. Where was your family headed in its mind's eye before history broke so dramatically over it?
Well, my parents were very happy to be part of this new Czechoslovakia, and my father wanted a career as a diplomat, and he had studied in France, and he prepared himself. You have to have a Doctor of Law degree in Europe to be a diplomat, or at least in Czechoslovakia, and he was the press attaché in Belgrade at the time that I was born. My mother wanted me to be born in Prague, and so she went there. There are people who believed that I was born in Belgrade, which was something they talked about when I was having such a hard time with Milosevic. But I was born in Prague. And then in March 1939, after the Munich Agreement in September 38, the Hitler invaded Prague, and that whole career was upended. And my father went to London, where he served the government in exile. And so I learned to speak English. In London. He broadcast for the BBC, and then he came back to Czechoslovakia on the first plane with President Beneš, and then he was named ambassador to Yugoslavia. So that was something, when you figure how much of my life as a professional I spent talking about the Balkans, it was kind of an interesting irony.
And then, I was struck throughout, Madeline, by how much of your life is presaged in early days and early settings. Of course, I suppose in many lives we can look back and in hindsight see that. But this wonderful picture you describe of yourself, I think in Belgrade, as the official child being sent out with bouquets of flowers and the Czech national costume, white blouse, large puffy sleeves embroidered in yellowy orange, and the patterned pink skirt to meet dignitaries on the arm of, or at the side of, I assume, your dad.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I used to say that's what I did for a living. But I really did get to meet an awful lot of people. And interestingly enough, the issues repeat themselves. So, for instance, there's so many points like this. One of the reasons that the reason we came to the United States was that the communists had taken over Czechoslovakia. And that was the first thing, I think, that finally made the U.S. realize that the Cold War was in full swing, and NATO was formed. And so then the fact that I worked on NATO expansion to bring in the country where I was born was another one of those issues that repeat themselves.
Another echo here. Your father was part of a UN effort. You would later, of course, be U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, but he had his own UN experience.
Right. And what had happened was that his next assignment after being ambassador in Yugoslavia was to be the Czechoslovak representative to the Commission on India and Pakistan that dealt with Kashmir. And he never reported to his own government because by then there had been a coup and the communists took over. But that also is an issue that I dealt with. I often used to say when I was at the UN that my father was dead, I was old, and the issue was as bad as it ever was. So I came to the United States because of the United Nations and then served there. So that is another one of the circles.
Your family took an enormous leap, formerly as refugees, ended up in Denver, where your father was a professor. You went to school and moved from being Madlenka, I guess your childhood name in Czechoslovakia and elsewhere, ultimately to Madeline, ultimately to Wellesley College. These are large steps over a short number of years.
Well, the part, it's interesting you point that out, because at the time they didn't seem so short, but all of a sudden I thought to myself that it was only 6 years from the time that we came to the United States that I ended up at Wellesley, and I was not an American citizen when I went there. I didn't become a citizen until 1957, and so very quickly there were these leaps. Of course, we had no idea where Denver was. I mean, my father got a job there thanks to the Rockefeller Foundation, and bought a green Ford coupe, and we drove to what is known as the Mile High City, and he kept saying, but we're never going up. Where is it?
He wanted to see the steep incline.
Right.
It was all in Nebraska and Kansas.
Somewhere.
You were catapulted really deeply into American society through romance and marriage. Can you share that story with us?
Well, I met my future husband one summer when I was working on the Denver Post. I had wanted to be a journalist, and he was a cub reporter. And we met and discovered that we were going to college very near each other because he went to Williams and I was at Wellesley. And we got married 3 days after graduating from college. And he comes from a really remarkable American family that had started a variety of newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune and the New York Daily News and the predecessor to the Washington Post and Newsday. And all of a sudden, I was in the middle of this very large American family, almost of noble proportions.
I mean, and of great wealth and great power and great expectations of your husband, who quickly became your husband, Joe Albright.
Right. And this was one of the great tragedies, is he had always been told that he was going to be publisher of Newsday because his aunt owned it together with Harry Guggenheim. And she was, I think, maybe 14 years younger than he was. But she died of a bleeding ulcer at age 56. And so Joe was not able to be given the chance, I think, to become publisher of Newsday, and that affected our lives a great deal, I believe.
But again, presaging here, that aunt, Alicia Patterson, famous in journalism circles, had a big house on Long Island where you would spend time, and you recall her spending time with Adlai Stevenson, just chit-chatting about everything under the sun, gossiping about the Riviera, but also talking about his life as U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Did you have any idea when you sat there as the young woman looking on that path might one day be yours?
Not a clue. And, what I had wanted to do, and I was of that class of women at Wellesley that were kind of a bridge class where we knew that we wanted to have interesting careers, but the major thing was to get married. And I certainly wanted to do both. And I had planned to be a journalist. I hadn't thought beyond that. And when I couldn't be a journalist, because in Chicago, Joe's editor had said I couldn't work on the same paper because of guild regulations, and I certainly wouldn't want to compete with him at another paper.
That is, compete with your husband.
My husband. I know what I would have said today to that kind of a remark, but at the time I just kind of saluted. But I had hoped very much that I could be an interesting wife and move into the academic field, and that we would live on Long Island, and not that I would ever have a public career. Because at that time, wives or husbands of journalists did not take political positions or public service.
But you weren't shy on that front eventually. But as you say, right in the beginning of the book, it's such an interesting part of your story, Madeleine Albright. Well into adulthood, you write, I was never supposed to be what I became. Is that a hallmark of being part of that bridge generation of women?
I think so, because I don't think any of us made kind of long-term plans. I think a lot of young women my age thought about being teachers for a while or trying to find careers that fit in with having a husband and children. That was kind of the hallmark. And I must say that when I started down getting a PhD path, which was something, frankly, that my father suggested to me, I did think that it mixed well with being a wife and mother. But I was criticized by some of the women my age because they thought that I should be at home more with my children. And I think one of the hardest parts I found is that sometimes women, we are each other's harshest critics. And so I've tried to learn from that we ought to be less judgmental about each other. But I had no idea that I would end up with a public career, none whatsoever.
We're talking tonight with Madeleine Albright, first female Secretary of State and the highest-ranking woman in the history of the United States government. We'll be back with more of her story from her new memoir, Madam Secretary, a memoir, Madeleine Albright. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Madeleine Albright, first female Secretary of State and the highest-ranking woman in the history of the United States government. She's out with a new memoir, Madam Secretary. Madeleine Albright, I was struck here. You're describing the birth of your daughters, your first children, twin daughters, 1961. And you describe how they were born early. In those days, they were put straight into the incubator. You were not allowed to be near them. Maybe you could tap on the glass, certainly not touch them. And you were going out of your mind trying to figure out how to occupy yourself. And you describe walking along, how you had walked past many times Hofstra College, now Hofstra University, and had seen a sign offering an intensive course in Russian language, took up Russian, and of course, here another significant step on your path towards such a big role in American foreign policy.
Well, I had always wanted to learn Russian. Being a Czech, the Slavic languages are related, and I knew at Wellesley that there was no point in taking first-year Russian because that would be too easy, but I couldn't take second-year Russian because I didn't know the alphabet. So this was a golden opportunity, and it certainly kept my mind off worrying about my children, and it did make me realize how much I liked to study and that I really did want to have a life that allowed me to develop my interests and develop some credentials. So even though I didn't know where I was going exactly, I did spend all those years getting more and more involved in politics, because once it became clear that Joe wasn't going to be publisher of Newsday, it also freed me up to be able to have political connections. So those combinations then went together, and he was incredibly supportive of my having a career. It was one of the reasons, I think, that we got along so well for so many years.
Joe went on to become a very productive newspaper reporter. But eventually, there's this middle terrain of your life, Madeleine Albright, where the strain on marriage comes, I guess, unexpectedly to you in many ways, but still becomes something that pulls it apart just as you're catapulting up into higher levels of the U.S. government. Can you describe that for us and tell us if you think that is or was, I guess was is the question, inevitable?
I have tried to analyze this as much as possible, and I must say again that I tried to write this out as clearly as I could. I have to say it was a very painful chapter, because just in the process of writing, as you well know, first you write it all down and you think, oh, I know I've said it, I've done it. Mm-hmm. And then you have to keep going over it, and the editors ask
yes, you
questions. And what is an irritating thing under any circumstances, when it is so personal, it is irritating and painful at the same time. But I tried very hard to come to a decision, and I couldn't. First of all, I do think it's part of being that bridge generation, that perhaps it turns out a very good friend of mine did a study of the classes at Wellesley that ended in nines. Mine was 59. Mm. And that was a class where there were the most divorces, because I think that the women that a man married did not turn out to be exactly the same people 10, 15 years later. And Hillary Clinton was 10 years younger, and she describes in her book how they really were very dedicated towards having careers from the moment they entered Wellesley. So anyway, I do think that while Joe had wanted to have an interesting wife, I don't know whether I was really exactly what he bargained for, but I do think this is that I never have been able to answer the question as to whether my career got in the way of my marriage. One, I have always found it insulting to women, and two, I just don't know the answer. Mm. And as I wrote in the book, I would have done anything to have Joe stay, including giving up whatever I was doing. And on the other hand, I also say that I doubt I ever would have become Secretary of State if I'd still been married to him. So it's a very difficult sentence and something difficult to come to, because I loved being married to Joe Albright, and I loved being Secretary of State.
You became increasingly politically active, then ended up as Chief Legislative Assistant to Senator Muskie of Maine, and not long after, sitting in the cabinet room at the White House as part of the National Security Council. Did it feel like a rapid ascent at the time?
Well, it did, except that I was so much older than everybody else. You know, when you work on the Hill, for any senator or congressman, most of the people are in their early 20s, and they are unmarried. This is their huge career beginning, and they are very involved with what they're doing. I was 39 when I went to work for Ed Muskie, and I had three children. Then, from there, it did ascend very rapidly, and I used to say often that my chronological age and my professional age didn't go together.
You were closely associated throughout with the Democratic Party. The 80s meant years out of government, academic years for you in large part. And then comes Bill Clinton and the return and real ascent of Madeleine Albright. Do you remember your first meetings with Bill Clinton? When did you know that this was a man, a president that you were interested in working with? Or did it matter who it was in the White House as long as he or she was in your party?
Well, first of all, I did give advice to a series of losing Democratic presidential candidates. I went out on the campaign trail a lot with the Mondale Ferraro campaign, and had advised also Michael Dukakis, which is when I did meet Bill Clinton. He had come as governor of Arkansas to be one of the people to kind of prep candidate Dukakis for debates. And it was very evident that he was very smart, very engaging. We had dinner, a bunch of us, with him. And then he and I started talking because he was a graduate of Georgetown School of Foreign Service, where I was teaching at the time. And I found him to be a completely brilliant politician and someone who obviously attracted a lot of support. The ironic part was that I never worked in his campaign because at that time I was running an independent think tank that was kind of offering advice to everybody, and we did not associate ourselves with one candidate. So having worked for a lot of other people that didn't make it, I didn't work for Bill Clinton, who did, but I was so delighted when he asked me to join his administration.
He came into office with Warren Christopher as his Secretary of State, and very shortly after, the query came to you, Madeleine Albright, would you be U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations? Why do you think it came to you, and what was your thinking when you were asked?
Well, I had a sense that there would be something I would be offered because there was a hue and cry for having more women in foreign policy roles. And I had, in the intervening years, if I may say so immodestly, put together a pretty good set of credentials in terms of not only having a PhD, but teaching at Georgetown University, and certainly having done my part in the political vineyard. So I thought I would get something, but I had no idea what. And when Sandy Berger, who was running the whole transition for national security, called me in to offer me the UN job, I was thrilled. But I had a friend, Richard Gardner, who had wanted to have that job forever. And so the first words out of my mouth were, "Richard Gardner will kill me," which I don't think was what I was supposed to be saying. But then when I was offered the job, I went down to Little Rock and had a wonderful interview with Governor Clinton, President-elect Clinton, and we talked about all the huge opportunities for the UN and how much he really wanted to support the United Nations and saw it as a vital part of how the U.S. does policy. So I was thrilled. He also made clear that it would be a cabinet-level job and that I would be part of what was known as the Principals Committee, the small group of people who actually create the policy that is then approved by the President of the United States. So all of a sudden, I really was in the inner circles and working at the UN at a time of its greatest promise.
People look back now and describe the 90s famously as a holiday from history. Did it feel that way at the time? Did it feel like this was a glorious time out when severe problems are at bay and the world gets to have a bit of a holiday from crisis?
I wouldn't describe it that way at all. I think that it was a wonderful period of opportunities to mold and restructure various institutions and try to sort out how it was appropriate to operate internationally after the Cold War. And so, just to take the UN, for example, it was beginning to live up to the dreams that President Roosevelt and President Truman had for it. As you know, it was frozen by the Cold War and the Soviet vetoes for so long. actually, the first President Bush showed that you could get a UN mandate for an international coalition for pursuing the first Gulf War. And for me, it was a time where we were able to try to figure out how peacekeeping operations work. There had been a number of what were previously known as operations where nobody from the UN would go in unless there already was peace, and it was more a peace maintenance than creating a peaceful situation. And so it was like being at a table drawing blueprints and having a possibility to see whether the UN could really function properly. And then later, when I was secretary, we still were working on how to revive and make relevant NATO and how to sign more international treaties on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty or Chemical Weapons Convention. And we thought that we were living in a period where we could make the international system work better with the U.S. at the center of it.
Why hasn't that multilateral world, that dream that seemed to be coming to flower in the 90s, why hasn't it proven sturdier, Madeleine Albright?
This may be a little bit controversial, but I think partially because this administration doesn't believe in it. I had always thought that the U.S. would be most comfortable within a system where, as a country ourselves, that's a country of the rule of law, that we would be comfortable in a system that operated, where treaties were honored, where you tried to create alliances and maintain them, where you believed that friends and allies were partners and not clients, and that we could, in fact, try to bring more countries into that kind of a system. I did say, I was criticized for it sometimes, I did say that the United States was the indispensable nation, and I so believe it as someone who saw what happens when the U.S. doesn't get involved on the right side. But I never said alone. I always felt that it was important for us to act in concert with others. And this administration came in very quickly and thought that it wasn't worth being in the anti-ballistic missile treaty or trying to get a better deal on Kyoto or to really work on making the International Criminal Court something that we could support fully. And I think that has had an effect.
You describe a fascinating moment in your time as UN ambassador when the United States is about to bomb Iraq, and you drop by the apartment of the Iraqi ambassador to the UN to let him know that bombs are going to fall. It seemed remarkably intimate and domestic doing that in his apartment.
It was very, very peculiar. And I think our listeners need to know this, is what happened was that we did not have regular friendly discussions with the Iraqi permanent representative. But because the Security Council was responsible for making sure that all the resolutions that came at the end of the first Gulf War were carried out, members of the permanent five members, the French and the British and the Chinese and the Russians, and we would on occasion meet with the Iraqis to give them what is known diplomatically as a démarche, in other words, tell them off. And that was usually done within the United Nations buildings. But the occasion that you describe, what happened was that there had been an attempt to assassinate former President Bush, and we had proof that the Iraqis were behind it and had determined that as retaliation we would bomb the intelligence headquarters in Baghdad. I was told that it was essential for me to notify the Iraqi permanent representative that we were doing this and that we were going to offer proof of their actions in the Security Council. But this was on a weekend, so all the buildings were closed. I didn't think I could invite him to my office, and so I had to go to his townhouse, which is on the Upper East Side of New York. And so we get there, and they ask my security people to stay outside. I only went in with one political officer, and they seat me on a sofa right under a huge portrait of Saddam Hussein. And Ambassador Hamdoun comes in and with a nice big smile and says, "So what brings you here today? May I offer you some tea?" I said, "Well, I'm actually here to tell you that the man in the portrait above me tried to assassinate our former president, and we are at this time bombing Baghdad." And he didn't offer me any more tea.
End of friendly tea.
End of that. And then I did go to the Security Council to offer the proof.
Within not so many years, you were Secretary of State and making history in that the first woman to hold that post. But throughout, as UN Ambassador and Secretary of State, Saddam Hussein is in the background, and maybe more than the background. You devote a whole chapter to migraine, as in headache, migraine Hussein. Was it clear to you how disruptive this man and this country might be?
Well, I didn't see it coming out exactly the way it has now, but I did, in fact, think and say that Saddam Hussein was one of the worst dictators, that we obviously had invaded another country and trashed it and taken prisoners and all their treasure, that he was torturing the Shias in the south, that he had, in fact, gassed the Kurds in the north, and that he was a brutal dictator, and that he had to account for the weapons of mass destruction that he had was known to have had at the beginning of the war, that the inspectors were systematically destroying. So I basically had said that I understood the why of the current Iraq war. We, in fact, took a number of actions against Saddam in the years during the Clinton administration and were bombing vigorously in the no-fly zones in the north and the south. So I thought he was clearly a horror for his own countrymen, that he was a potential threat to the region, but that we had him in a strategic box through the bombing. I did not believe that he was an imminent threat to us.
You had so many crises and challenges in those years, Somalia, Rwanda, Haiti, Bosnia. If you could go back and do Iraq again, is there something that you might have steered differently that might have steered us away from this very sticky involvement we're in now?
That's a very hard question, because I am now teaching a course on what the tools of national security are. What is it that a country has the capability to do against somebody that we consider evil or a threat? And there's diplomacy, there are economic tools, sticks and carrots, or the use of force. That's it, in some kind of combination. I think the hard part that happened was that Iraq was under a very heavy sanctions regime, which we managed to hold together, but that began to deteriorate. And we had begun to think about what the Bush administration later started talking about also were smart sanctions that would be directed only at the leadership of the regime. I think it might have been interesting if we'd been able to do that, which might have, in fact, brought greater support from the Iraqi public.
What kind of sanctions, Madeline Albright, that could
be? Well, these were things that we actually started using in Bosnia and Kosovo against Milosevic, which is to target the leadership by cutting off their source of finances, by making sure that none of the leaders can travel. One of the problems with sanctions is, as we know, they're a very blunt instrument and they hurt everybody.
Madeline Albright, stand by, please. We've got to take a short break. I'm talking tonight with the first female Secretary of State and the highest-ranking woman in the history of the United States government, Madeline Albright, her new memoir. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Madeline Albright, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, former Secretary of State. Her new memoir is Madam Secretary. Madeline Albright, you write in your memoir something that everybody knows, but it's, I'm sure, much more apparent when you step into the kind of shoes that you've worn, the kind of roles that you've held. That is, presidents do not inherit a clean slate. Bill Clinton did not inherit a clean slate. George W. Bush did not inherit a clean slate. And with that frame in mind, I wish you'd share with us your thoughts as you absorbed 9/11, 2001, and those attacks, having overseen so much of U.S. foreign policy for the previous decade. How did you interpret, how did you take on what we were all seeing that day?
Well, I obviously, like every American, was horrified at the tragedy and the fact that something like this could even happen. And I think my absorption of it was similar to everybody else's. But I think that obviously I, along with everybody else, tried to figure out how it had happened and whether we could have done anything in our time. to prevent it. So I can assure you there was a great deal of soul searching. We lived throughout our administration, especially from like 95 on, with the threat of terrorism. And President Clinton had spoken about it very early on, when I was still at the UN at the General Assembly, about the fact that terrorists had no place to hide. I had to begin to deal with it personally in 1998, August 1998, my worst time as Secretary of State, when our embassies blew up in Kenya and Tanzania, and we were able to trace that to bin Laden and immediately launch 75 cruise missiles against him in Afghanistan. We worked very hard on trying to develop more mechanisms for tracking him, and would have hit many more times had we had appropriate intelligence. We never did. And so we've gone over this in our minds. I do think the following thing that was evident to me at the time was that there was not enough cooperation between the CIA and the FBI, which we clearly were able to see around 9/11. But I think we knew already about the threats of terrorism. I write about how my daily fare was to get a report about what was going on around every embassy, how we tried to mitigate various events. And in fact, there are many what I would call incidents of where the dog didn't bark, where we were able to foil terrorist acts. But I think everybody examines what could have been done. And in my own mind, I think we did everything that it was possible to do, given the intelligence that we had.
With your front row seat there, did you live day by day thinking, my gosh, there's a terrorist threat to this country that people just don't fully appreciate? Is it possible to ring the alarm bells in a way that they're heard in advance of without the kind of devastating attack that there was on 2001? Or was the threat actually... did ultimately prove to be larger, more radical than you even imagined?
Well, I think both things, frankly. What happened was that we were aware of the great terrorist threat and tried to warn against it. And, you know, it was so amazing, despite the fact that an American embassy is basically American territory, and I had the honor and sad tragedy of bringing home the bodies of the Americans who died in Kenya, it wasn't America itself. And if people put their minds back, we were actually criticized for having reacted the way we did with the cruise missiles and bombing a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan, which we knew to be connected with Osama bin Laden. And we were told we were overreacting, wag the dog, if you remember. So it did sound alarmist, and people didn't understand it. That's the great tragedy. And I think we tried everything we could and set up whatever systems we could to try to make sure these things didn't happen. When we briefed our successors on the amount of time that we spent dealing with how to fight terrorism and how to deal with specific issues, they were all very surprised that we spent that much time on it. And I think, unfortunately, they had the worst of what happened in 9/11. But, you know, I've thought about this a lot. I've thought also that finger-pointing on it is counterproductive. Whether they took it seriously or we took it seriously, it is unfortunately what we live with today. And I applaud what is being done. I hope more can be done on homeland security and that we are all on alert at this point.
But 9/11 came, it landed on the Bush administration. You've written very recently and at some length about where George W. Bush's foreign policy has left the United States and where it's taken the world. Bring us completely up to date on the Madeleine Albright view of things. We kind of urgently need perspective here. As I read you, you're saying President Bush has drawn the lines a little differently than you would have.
Well, as I said earlier, I really do believe that this country is an indispensable power by virtue of our size, our power, and our ideals, and that we are very special. That may come from the fact that I wasn't born here, and I really am very patriotic, and I really, through my own life, can see what a difference it makes when the U.S. is involved, and I won't rehearse all that, but I do believe that. But I never did believe in the go it alone, nor have I believed, as some have written, that the United States is like Gulliver tied down by the Lilliputians when we are part of some kind of an alliance system. Building consensus and the use of diplomacy, I think, is very important. And I think that what this administration has done is to try, by its choices, to make the rest of the world make choices that I think are not necessary. For instance, they have linked Al-Qaeda to Iraq. There was a group of people who wanted to have a go at Iraq again because they had lost the fight in the first Bush administration. First there was the issue, accept the fact that Iraq is a threat to us. Then they wanted us to understand that there was a link to Al-Qaeda. Then they wanted us to take the fact that that preemption was a good idea, that military preemption was the way to go. And this has even been pushed into the fact that they now want us to study the potential use of small nuclear weapons. So they are basically constantly pushing the edge of the envelope and putting other countries whom we need for alliance purposes into a position of having to make very difficult choices.
And you're seeing this as a largely pre-cooked agenda. You'd like to reframe the choices. How would you do that?
Well, I think that we do need to understand that there are certain countries and issues that are threats to us. They are better dealt with first by having very intensive diplomacy so that we can try to get on the same page, and then, if not possible, to use force. But to all of a sudden put preemption on the table and the potential use of nuclear weapons, I think, is the wrong way to go. The other thing that I would try to do is to realize that not only is unilateral foreign policy unacceptable, but unidimensional foreign policy is, where we don't consider all the other aspects of how we relate to other countries, that a lot these days has to do with issues that are transnational, on human rights, on drugs, on global warming, on the rule of law, and on issues where you need the cooperation of other countries. I would try very much to put more emphasis on diplomacy, on assistance, and on dealing with these issues that can't all be dealt with through a military prism.
If put yourself inside the Bush bubble now, do you imagine that there's a real conversation about maybe turning more toward that approach, or do you feel that this administration is locked in to the strategy that it's pursuing?
I do think that there is some turn towards understanding the value of diplomacy, and I say this because there clearly is some diplomatic movement taking place on North Korea. There was an attempt briefly a month ago or so on diplomacy in the Middle East, and there is an attempt now to try to get some United Nations support for what we're doing in Iraq. But this takes a real effort by everybody, and I do think it may be coming about because reality has finally kind of checked in. There are facts out there in the world that require a way to deal with them in some way other than by bombing.
Madeleine Albright, it's a remarkable life story you bring to us and a rich perspective. We're so grateful to you for sharing it with us tonight. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for your questions. I really enjoyed them, Tom.
Madeleine Albright was U.S. Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001. She was the first woman to serve as State Department Chief. 63 men held that position before her. Her new memoir is Madam Secretary. You can read the first chapter of her book at our website. Go to onpointradio.org. I'm joined now by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack. Good to have you along.
Thank you.
You know, we had to record this a couple of hours ago with Madeleine Albright. The time just flew by. We didn't even get to the fact that it was around the time or on the day of President Clinton's second inauguration that Madeleine Albright, newly named Secretary of State in the Eye of the World, learned in the Eye of the World that she was actually of Jewish parentage, hadn't known that. Three of her grandparents died in World War II. Her parents had kept this from her, it seems, as part of their move out of all the hell of the Holocaust and their move to the United States. This is a woman who's had to take a lot on board in her lifetime.
She certainly has. She said to you, "I was never supposed to be who I became." speaking of herself as a member of that bridge generation of women, who class of 1959 at Wellesley College, who had to go from family to career, and sometimes fell down. Sometimes the bridge collapsed, as hers did, her marriage. A very striking and really emblematic story in that respect. For all that's unique about her, lots of women have been on that bridge. I just want to make a couple of observations, Tom, if I could.
Sure.
One is about things that she said, and two about Clinton policy. You know, she made two of the most, unfeeling comments of any Secretary of State in my memory. One was, memorably, when Colin Powell, early on in the administration, she along with others wanted intervention in the Balkans, mm-hmm. and Powell objected. He was Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he said, no, I don't want to use the army for this, and I don't want to have my soldiers having to be shot at and die in the Balkans. And she said something like, what are your soldiers for, if not that?
What's the use of this big military if we're not going to use it?
That's right. And Powell said he had angina. He almost had a heart attack on the spot. And then in an interview on CBS, she talks about this in her memoir, and she said she wanted to eat her words when Leslie Stahl asked her, what about the, I believe it was, 400,000 children, Iraqi children, who died as a result of U.S.-led sanctions on Iraq?
Leslie Stahl actually said 500,000, it was the report at the time.
Half a million, yeah. And she made a response in which she used the phrase that it was perhaps worth the price. There isn't a single literate person in the Arab world who doesn't know that statement. And yes, we understand that Saddam played with the sanctions and he was using the sanctions for his own purposes, but not all those children died for that reason. Many of them are on our heads and on the heads of our policymakers. And this was a remarkably insensitive thing to say. And I wonder if both comments didn't come out of a sort of compensatory swagger that, you know, a pioneer woman had to show in the realms of power. She had to be tougher than the toughest guy. And boy, this was tough talk.
That was tough. Madeleine Albright says in her memoir that, in fact, flying in jets around the world with the symbol of the United States government on their side, she typically got pretty great respect abroad, but that at home was where she felt the pressure, and especially in the halls of power back in the USA, at being a woman in that high station.
I'm sure the condescension was just there all the time, but she's a person of formidable reputation and merit. But, you know, about the Clinton policy, the policy she served, the Bush people are making more and more of the claim, or at least some of them, that their policy is continuous with Clinton, that there isn't a sharp break, that the humanitarian interventions of the Balkans of the Clinton years really paved the way for the Iraq deployment, and they cite all the time Bill Clinton's not going to the UN over Kosovo. Clinton did it. We did it. And, you know, historians will look back, I think, and say and see more of a continuity there than the Clinton people who stress, as she did, the preemptive nature, the go-it-alone nature. They'll stress, I think, the elements of continuity between Clinton and Bush.
They may, and yet there's a difference in theme. Madeleine Albright writes in Foreign Affairs, she's afraid this administration has played into the hands of extremists who would like nothing better than to make the clash of civilizations the defining struggle of our age. She says that's not the way she'd go. Well, she's out of power, but she's talking, and it's interesting to see and hear from that top branch. Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileena Mata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skok. With help from Sarah Cook, Darren Manoogian, and John Parati, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook.